young people in the United States, and the military is made up of young people in the United States. And so that shift in consciousness has happened in the military as well. And they have been watching and decided that they couldn't support a government that would kill children with impunity. And then here we are in a war that the U.S. is not only waging with that country, but begins that war by carrying out the kind of action that Israel became notorious for throughout that war. And so they're having to look at themselves and say, what am I willing to do? What kind of person am I? Can I be a part of the kinds of atrocities that I've turned against over the past several years?
And we just have 10 seconds, but several cases of service members who have imminent deployments being taken off the deployment roster when they're considering applying for conscientious objector status.
That is something we can fight for. Your command is obligated to accommodate your beliefs. Look, most people will say you joined the military. It doesn't matter if you think it's immoral. You signed up for this. You have to follow orders. Well, nobody signed up to violate their conscience. Nobody signed up to violate their deeply held beliefs. And you know what? There are DOD policies that can protect you from having to exercise that. And we
Mike
can help you
Price,
exercise that.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director for the Center on Conscience and War. Tune in tonight at 7 to our live stream at democracynow.org for our 30th anniversary celebration of Democracy Now! Featuring Angela Davis and Patti Smith and Michael Stipe and so many others. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO-FM every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon. Co-hosts O.B. Hill, Patricia Welch, and Emma Jackson Ford discuss African-American authors and books. That's Black Book Talk every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon on KBOO-FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Public Schools shortens the academic year.
LaGuardia Airport is the scene of a deadly air crash.
And in international news, the UK continues to experience anti-Semitic attacks.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 23rd, 2026. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. Portland Public Schools is turning 4 days that were originally intended for teaching, grading, or paid time off into furlough days. This move, intended to help fix a budget deficit, effectively ends the school year early. The furlough deal was just announced to the PPS community yesterday. It followed negotiations with the district's educator union, the Portland Association of Teachers. Oregon's largest school district has long been grappling with an unexpected and growing budget deficit. In the original disclosure, it was a $22 million mid-year shortfall, with $12 million in savings already identified. A few weeks later, the district revised the estimate gap upwards to $14 million. It is quite rare for a district to have a significant deficit in the middle of a school year, although the Reynolds School District was also in the red after this school year had started. The new PPS agreement ends the school year on Friday, June 5th, canceling school on June 9th and eliminating a grading day on June 10th. The district is also canceling school on Friday, May 1st. The fourth furlough day is Memorial Day, Monday, May 25th. It will become an unpaid day off.
In breaking news, the Department of Defense just announced it will take action in response to the recent federal court ruling that parts of its media policy are unconstitutional. The Pentagon is closing the workspace used by military-certified journalists, and all journalists seeking physical access to the Pentagon will require an escort. The wording of the rules journalists must agree to is also being modified, more explicitly defining the definitions of prohibited activities. The DOD will appeal the ruling, but the new rules will apply in the meantime, even though the Pentagon is not, quote, conceding the validity of the court's analysis. The New York Times had sued, saying DOD rules violated the First and Fifth Amendments. Judge Paul Friedman sided with the paper. Friedman wrote, "The policy rewarded reporters willing to publish only stories favorable to the government or which has been spoon-fed by the government." He also ordered the Pentagon to restore the passes of 7 New York Times journalists.
An Air Canada jet carrying more than 70 passengers collided with a fire truck while landing at New York's LaGuardia Airport late last night, killing the pilot and co-pilot and injuring several others. 2 port employees in the fire truck suffered injuries that were not believed to be life-threatening. The fire truck was crossing the tarmac after an air traffic controller gave it permission to respond to another plane reporting an odor on board. Before the collision, an air traffic controller can be heard on airport communications frantically telling the fire truck to stop. Later, the controller appears to take the blame for the accident, saying, quote, "We were dealing with an emergency earlier. I messed up." About 40 passengers and crew members on the regional jet were taken to hospital, some with serious injuries. Most were released by this morning. The impact crushed the regional jet's nose, leaving cables and debris dangling from the mangled cockpit. Stairways used to evacuate passengers from the aircraft were pushed up to the emergency exits on the jet. The fire truck was seen flipped onto its side. The accident shut down LaGuardia, the New York region's third busiest hub, during what was already a messy time at U.S. airports. Travelers have been facing long security lines due to a government shutdown in a busy spring break travel season. The fire truck was traveling across the runway to respond to a separate incident aboard a United Airlines flight, whose pilot had reported, quote, "an issue with odor." There were 72 passengers and 4 crew members aboard the aircraft, a Jazz Aviation flight operating on behalf of Air Canada. The flight originated at the Montreal International Airport. An air traffic controller did try to stop the vehicle after giving clearance. The transmission says, quote, "Stop, Truck 1, stop." The controller can then be heard frantically trying to divert an incoming aircraft from landing. Air traffic controllers are not impacted by the partial government shutdown that has caused long delays at airport security checkpoints. LaGuardia is one of 35 major airports across the country equipped with an advanced surface surveillance system that uses radar and data from locator systems on planes to alert controllers to potential conflicts on runways, according to the FAA. It's still too early to tell exactly what went wrong, and a number of groups are investigating the crash.
A GOP candidate in California has seized a huge number of ballots. The U.S. Senate continues to debate the SAVE Act, and Senate Democratic leadership is under attack. With those stories and more, it's Zamon Paris with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Physically count the ballots and compare that result with the total votes reported. A.G. Bonta, in his direction, claims that an investigation into the elections sows mistrust in our system. That is absolutely ridiculous.
Riverside County, California Sheriff Chad Bianco has seized more than 600,000 ballots from last year's vote approving California redistricting. Bianco says a group of citizens who say they, quote, did their own audit found 45,000 excess votes. Local election officials describe that as detached from reality. California Attorney General Rob Bonta calls the ballot seizure a threat to democracy, not based on facts or evidence. The state's redistricting ballot measure won by a landslide of more than 3 million votes. Bianco is a vocal supporter of President Donald Trump. Trump and a leading Republican candidate for governor. A recent poll found him and conservative commentator Steve Hilton narrowly leading in a crowded primary field for the June 2nd primary. Democratic votes are split among multiple candidates. In the state's jungle primary, the top two candidates will advance to a runoff. The U.S. Senate is entering the second week of a marathon debate on the SAVE Act, a long-shot effort to pass a Trump priority that would require strict proof of citizenship to register or vote. Voter ID is broadly popular, but few know about or support what's in the specific bill. A new CBS poll finds a little more than a quarter of ordinary voters approve of it. Just short of a third oppose it, and half of Republicans polled say they know little to nothing about it. Democrats like Vermont Senator Peter Welch say Republicans are unpopular and are trying to win by suppressing votes.
You couldn't use a military ID to qualify under the SAVE Act. You'd have to get like a passport. There's 69 million women who have taken the name of their husband, and they wouldn't be able to vote without enormous hassles.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer may face a rebellion in next year's leadership race. The party's popularity is at historic lows, driven by liberal and progressive voters who view Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries as ineffective in opposing Trump in his second term. On NBC, Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy would not say whether he'd support Schumer, saying only the caucus is united in opposing many Trump policies.
We are united as a caucus right now. We are united in ending this war. We are united in reining in the lawlessness of ICE, and we're going to be united in winning the election this November.
Anti-Schumer Democratic Senate candidates like State Senator Mallory McMorrow in Michigan and Maine Oysterman Graham Plattner have support. Last week, progressive Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton won her Senate primary after saying she would oppose again electing Schumer as leader. Several U.S. House members are calling on Colorado Democratic Governor Jared Polis to resist calls to grant clemency to former Mesa County clerk and election denier Tina Peters. Peters was convicted on 7 counts related to voter fraud conspiracy theories, including granting unauthorized access to voting machines. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
New York City is, simply put, an unaffordable place to live. But a proposed fix, raising the minimum wage to $30 per hour, may not be a workable solution. Edwin J. Vieira has more on the story.
The New York City Council is considering a bill that would raise the minimum wage significantly. It calls for an incremental increase to raise the minimum wage from $17 to $30 an hour by 2030. The bill has strong public support as the city's residents face widespread unaffordability. But Rebecca Paxton with the Employment Policies Institute warns it may have more drawbacks than benefits.
There's overwhelming evidence drastic minimum wage hikes cause job losses, and that can also include schedule reductions, less overtime opportunities for people who want to pick up shifts, so folks can actually see working less and not being able to earn as much as they were before.
Reports show New York City restaurants lost 10,000 jobs during the summer of 2025 compared to previous years. Some analysts attribute this trend to high wages and rising costs. Councilmember Sandy Nurse, the bill's sponsor, argues the city's minimum wage is a poverty wage, leaving more than a million workers living on $500 a week. However, research suggests minimum wage hikes like this may cause businesses to stagnate. In 2024, California increased the minimum wage for fast food jobs to $20. After the law was passed, data show this led to a loss of more than 19,000 jobs. A survey from the Economic Policy Institute finds 89% of business owners said they were less likely to expand in California. Nearly all the restaurants surveyed also said they increased prices. Paxton says New York City should take note of this.
Prices went up, so the people who were buying fast food, residents and maybe some of those workers now have to buy the food that they were buying before at a higher price point. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest minimum wages contribute to inflation as well.
Other wage hikes aren't showing better results. Ahead of the 2028 Olympics, Los Angeles implemented a $30 minimum wage for hotel workers, but a new report finds hotels are now reducing staff because they can't afford to pay the new wage. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Coast Range Radio. We will learn everything there is to know about bird migration. At 6, it's Labor Radio. 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will show light winds and clouds. The low, well, roughly 48 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be showers in the morning. That'll progress into steady rain. The high will be near 55. Today in history, In 1775, Patrick Henry gave his Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech at St. John's Episcopal Church in Richmond, Virginia. And in 1806, after researching the Pacific Ocean, explorers Lewis and Clark turned around and began their journey home. The quote of the day is also from Patrick Henry. Henry stated, "For my part, whatever anguish of the spirit it may cost, I'm willing to know the whole truth, to know the worst, and to provide for it."
Four ambulances belonging to a Jewish charity were set on fire earlier today in London. British police are investigating the incident as a potential anti-Semitic hate crime. Even though it has not been classified as a terrorist incident, counter-terrorism officers have been put in charge of the investigation. Prime Minister Keir Starmer labeled this as a horrific anti-Semitic attack. He said, quote, "Anti-Semitism has no place in our society, and it's really important that we all stand together at a moment like this," end quote. Officers were called to Golders Green, a North London neighborhood with a large Jewish population, after receiving reports of a fire. Four ambulances belonging to Hetzola Northwest, a volunteer organization that provides emergency medical responses, were damaged. Multiple oxygen cylinders on the vehicles exploded, breaking windows in a nearby apartment. Multiple homes were then evacuated as a precaution. What appeared to be footage from a security camera showed three figures in black and wearing hoods carrying a canister toward one of the ambulances before flames erupted around the vehicle. Police said they are looking for three suspects, but no arrests have been made. The attack seriously concerns Britain's Jewish community, which feels increasingly vulnerable. Shomrim, a nonprofit organization which operates a neighborhood watch in the area, condemned the attack as, quote, "a targeted and deeply concerning incident affecting a vital emergency service serving the local Jewish community." The number of anti-Semitic incidents reported across the UK has dramatically increased since the Hamas October 7, 2023 terrorist attack on Israel and the ensuing war in Gaza. There were 3,700 reported incidents last year, more than double the count from a few years prior. Some members of the community have criticized Starmer's Labour Party government for failing to prevent anti-Semitic speech and acts. Peter Zinkin, a conservative politician who represents Golders Green on the local council, said the community felt distress and anger. He said, quote, "Burning ambulances in the middle of the night is a disgrace, and you have to ask yourself, why did it happen? And the reason I'm afraid that it happened is that the government and the media, particularly certain parts of the media, have validated anti-Semitism on a countrywide scale," end quote. The Archbishop of Canterbury, head of the Anglican Church, said, quote, "Such acts of violence, hatred, and intimidation have no place in our society."
The majority of U.S. Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders believe Donald Trump has done more harm than good on the issue of immigration and border security. This, according to a new AAPI data/APNORC poll. About 6 in 10 AAPI adults say Trump has hurt immigration and border security a lot or a little, compared with about 4 in 10 U.S. adults in general. Recently, about two-thirds of AAPI adults, who are generally more likely to be Democrats than U.S. adults overall, also said Trump has gone too far when it comes to deporting immigrants living in the U.S. illegally, compared with about half of Americans in general. Trump's administration has instituted sweeping immigration measures since he took office, which have become increasingly aggressive. In December 2024, daily detentions averaged just under 40,000. Last month, they numbered about 70,000. Jeff Ugai says, rather lives in Hawaii on his island Kauai. Nearly four dozen people were arrested in November in immigration raids. Ugai said, quote, "It seems like the current administration's efforts have been exploring the views of Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders, who are usually not highlighted in other surveys because of small sample size and lack of linguistic representation.
A community in Alaska historically has put on polar bear tours. Some members are trying to bring the practice back. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Inupiat community of Kaktovik in northern Alaska is known as the polar bear capital of the U.S. Hundreds of tourists used to flock to the village of about 250 people to see bears. But several years ago, the tours were halted because of opposition from residents. Ayolna Nyden with the Alaska Desk has more on what happened to the tours and what the tribe's doing to revive them.
It's polar bear ground right there.
Nathan Gordon Jr. is driving his truck on the spit right outside of Kaktovik. He's mayor and leads the town's polar bear patrol program. Under his back seat, he has a shotgun, and in his console, shotgun rounds and cracker shells. Kaktovik sits on Barter Island on the Beaufort Sea coast. In late summer and fall, up to 80 polar bears come on land, a trend that has been increasing as the sea ice diminishes. That brought the need for patrol and created opportunities for polar bear viewing. The pandemic put a pause on visitation. Then the federal government halted the tours. Gordon says Kaktovik leaders have been working to revive them.
Let's get this place back to making money, and it'll be great for everybody.
Kitil Reitan started the company Kaktovik Tours in 2010. By 2019, he and his two children took several hundred tourists a season.
We were able to make a year income in about 6 weeks.
The number of tourists soared from about 50 in 2010 to over 1,000. Tourism grew so quickly, residents were worried it was interfering with subsistence practices. Nora Jane Burns says that visitors would book out seats on small flights and limit the amount of freight that was coming in.
Especially when we have elders that go out for medical, and then when they try to come back, the flights would be booked.
The COVID-19 pandemic shut down the tours. A year later, the U.S. Department of Interior issued an order to pause commercial polar bear viewing permits. Since then, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been collaborating with the city and village of Kaktovik, as well as Kaktovik Inupiat Corporation. Gordon says that this time around, he wants the community to develop infrastructure for tourists and focus more on educating them. But who will run the tours? Burns is busy with her job at Kaktovik Public Works Department, and Rayton sold his boats and moved to Nome. But they both hope the younger generation will take over polar bear tours. I am Alona Nyden.
A South Dakota high schooler is receiving one of the nation's highest honors for citizens by the Congressional Medal of Honor Society. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Jackson Dirks reports, the student has helped provide food, backpacks, holiday gifts, and essentials to children and families on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Cody Tubles came up with an idea 4 years ago at baseball practice. His teammates told him they didn't have backpacks and school supplies. Tubles began trying to find donations to help his teammates, but pretty quickly realized there were a lot of people needing the resources.
Instead of helping out just specifically my teammates or my family, what if I did it for everyone?
Tubles created what's called baseball and backpacks. People donate items on Walmart and Amazon shopping lists, and those get sent to Tubles' house. He then gathers the items, things like notebooks and toiletries, into backpacks for students. The giveaway is done at a baseball field where, simultaneously, Tubles holds a baseball clinic that teaches kids the fundamentals of the sport. There are four of these different drives annually. He does this on top of being a multi-sport athlete at Makpialuta. Tubles is one of five individuals in the country named a 2026 Citizen Honors Award recipient. He's receiving the Service Act Award, which honors Americans who consistently place others before themselves through a focused initiative of volunteer service.
It's crazy to me how, just by helping others, I was able to get recognized for that.
He'll be honored March 25th in Washington, D.C. I'm Jackson Dirks.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Pregnant persons in rural Texas may have to drive hours to get maternal care. Things are reaching the breaking point. Frida Ross tells us more.
The Rural Texas Maternal Health Assembly says the state is teetering on a crisis in maternal health, as 47% of Texas counties are considered maternity care deserts. Only 70 rural hospitals in the state now provide obstetrics care to expectant mothers. Dr. Jacqueline Alvarado with Texas A&M Rural and Community Health Institute says some pregnant people can travel up to 3 or 4 hours for a routine checkup and are missing out on wraparound services.
So they may have a WIC opportunity, but they don't have a grocery store available. So they're stuck eating very processed foods and behavioral health services and postpartum lactation. These women want to breastfeed, but they don't have access to that support.
Among hospitals still providing labor and delivery services, 59% report financial losses for each service. Medical experts say without access to local preventive and primary care, women living in rural communities are more likely to miss important cancer screenings, postpartum care, and contraceptive services. Alvarado says telehealth appointments are helpful in bridging the gap.
And that's a great care model, which allows those women to receive some point of care throughout their pregnancy, but also getting creative with it. If they don't have great internet access at home, let's bring them to the local rural health clinic.
Alvarado says the majority of maternal deaths in the U.S. are considered preventable and thinks rural areas should receive comparable funding, training, and services as urban areas.
It's financial, but geography shouldn't determine whether you deserve that care or not. I feel like in a country with so many resources and expertise, where a woman lives, it really shouldn't determine whether she survives her pregnancy or not.
She says she's hopeful the Rural Health Transformation Program, which provides states with federal funding to improve rural health care systems, will improve maternal health services in the state. Texas is receiving $1.4 billion over 5 years as part of the program. I'm Frieda Ross, Texas News Service.
Idaho, like many states, is facing a severe nursing shortage. At least one community college is stepping up. Laura Hatch has more on the story.
Treasure Valley Community College near the Idaho-Oregon border is upgrading its nursing training center to help address the rural health care crisis. The Evelyn S. Dame Nursing and Allied Health Professions Center on campus is a 30,000-square-foot building set for completion in late May. Mara Pointer, Executive Director of Nursing and Allied Health at the college, says the new center fully launches in the fall and will be state-of-the-art.
We've been teaching nursing in our current space since the 1960s, so everything is going to be a full upgrade from simulation center to Zoom-ready classrooms.
Pointer says that new simulation center will give students a wide range of patient care experiences, preparing them for nursing jobs after graduation. She hopes the expanded facility will attract more students to help fill the demand for nurses in the state. Idaho ranks 43rd in the nation for its number of nurses, at 7.3 nurses for every 1,000 residents. Along with the nursing shortage, Pointer says it can be a challenge to recruit and retain health care workers in rural areas. She says it's helpful for new graduates to leave for bigger cities to get broader experience, and that rural communities need to find ways to bring them back.
How do we transition? How do we encourage and how do we incentivize students that have passion for rural care to not only stay, but then to potentially come back to provide what the community needs?
Treasure Valley Community College will offer a Bachelor of Science in Nursing starting this fall, adding to its 10-week certificate programs and associate's degrees. I'm Laura Hatch, Northern Rockies News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 23rd, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. The producer is my co-anchor, Josh Salem, and our engineer is Mike Fataklis. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonio Gonzalez, Frieda Ross, Catherine Carley, Zamon Perez, and Laura Hatch. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Today, we're talking birds. Are they real? Just kidding. I'm delighted to be joined today by Rebecca Heisman, freelance journalist and the author of Flight Paths, how a passionate and quirky group of pioneering scientists solved the mystery of bird migration. Flight Paths is a fascinating and engaging deep dive into the history and science of bird migration research and how understanding bird migration matters for effective conservation efforts. My email box is always open at coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Drop me a line with show ideas, guest suggestions, scathing criticisms, or whatever. Coast Range Radio is free on all podcast apps. We're also proud to be aired on community radio stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. And please support those community radio stations and your public media in general. Okay, let's get to the interview. Rebecca Heisman, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I just finished your book last night, actually, and I learned so much. And as somebody who would like to someday call himself a birder, it was a great read, and I can't wait to talk with you about it. I was hoping that you could start us off with a reading from Flight Path.
Sure. So this is from the beginning of Chapter 4. On the morning of May 13th, 1973, a Swainson's thrush, pausing on its journey from its winter home to its summer home, blundered into a mist net in east central Illinois. The researchers who gently pulled it from the net went through all the usual rituals, weighing and measuring it, clasping